Today at Reader's Corner, Rachel Louise Snyder, author of No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. Reader's Corner, Fridays at 6 p.m. and Sunday mornings at 11 on Boise State Public Radio News. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In America, domestic violence accounts for 15% of all violent crime. The World Health Organization calls it a global epidemic, yet we still don't seem to understand the true measure of the problem. In No Visible Bruises, journalist Rachel Louise Snyder gives context to domestic violence. She frames this urgent and immersive account of the scale of domestic violence in our country around key stories and common myths. Snyder explores the real roots of domestic violence, its far-reaching consequences for society, and what it will take to address it. Rachel Louise Snyder's work has appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, The Washington Post, and elsewhere. Her other books include Fugitive Denim and the novel What We've Lost Is Nothing. She has been the recipient of an Overseas Press Award for her work on This American Life. No Visible Bruises was awarded the J. Anthony Lucas Work in Progress Award, and she is an associate professor at American University. Rachel Louise Snyder, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Rachel, this is a somewhat unusual approach to what is normally just a quick 30-minute interview with an author. I have a guest in the studio today, and that would be Representative Melissa Wintrow, who is the author of legislation dealing with this subject of domestic violence and especially the role that guns play in it. But for starters, why don't you help us, and I'm going to ask Melissa to jump in here in a few minutes, why don't you start us off with helping us out with the scale of this problem that I didn't even appreciate it, of course, until I read your book.
Well, I didn't fully appreciate it until I was writing it, so you're not alone there. When I wrote the book, it accounted for 15% of all violent crime in this country, as you said. I have just learned that it now accounts for 20% of all violent crime in this country. For years and years, the statistic was that we were losing about 3 women a day to domestic violence homicide in this country. Since 2017, that figure is up now 33%. And what I didn't fully understand was really how much domestic violence and domestic violence homicide intersects so many of the pressing social issues that we look at today, from, you know, mass shootings to poverty to, you know, gender inequity to education and healthcare. You'll find domestic violence at the core of all of those issues. It accounts for more than half of all homelessness, direct result for homeless women, in fact. So it just is, it's really, truly just staggering in scope and in breadth.
What do you think would happen if men died of the same number of domestic violence abuses?
Well, it's funny that you say that, because the first piece I ever wrote for The New Yorker, I actually said that in an email to my editor, and I said, you know, if men were dying in these numbers, we'd have, you know, the National Institute of Health and National Science Foundation just throwing millions of dollars of research to find out what's wrong with our women, that they're killing our men in these numbers. I mean, in my book, and this is a stat that came out of one of my New Yorker articles from the Fact Checker, she found that between 2001 and 2005, we lost 3 times as many victims to domestic violence homicide in this country as we did soldiers in foreign wars. So that puts a little perspective on where our priorities are.
Speaking of soldiers of foreign wars, I think there was something in your book about the brain scans of the victims and veterans of foreign wars. Could you help us with that?
Yeah, that was just shocking to me. Like, I felt that in my heart when I read it, that the brain scans of domestic violence victims are the same in terms of the neurological hardware that they are in prisoners of war when they come back from being soldiers come back from being prisoners of war. That sort of constant stress that you live under day in and day out, year in and year out in some cases. And it just gives an idea of how poorly we're framing the real issue here.
Well, there's domestic violence, and then there's the extreme form of domestic violence, which is, of course, domestic homicide. And, of course, guns play a prominent role. in that. I don't think there's many cases. Well, there's some cases, but let's face it, most cases are going to involve guns where there's a domestic homicide. And I'd like for Melissa Wintrow to jump in here. Representative Wintrow has been working on legislation, and maybe she can begin by explaining to our listeners and you as well, Rachel, what her bill does. And then I know she's also read your book and may have a couple of questions as well.
Great.
Melissa.
Thanks, Dr. Custra. So the story actually starts with a few years ago when I was teaching class, and a student of mine told me that she had been experienced actually the witness of her mother being shot by her father. And she, a couple semesters later, came back to me with her sister and said, hey, would you do something to help us? And she wanted to pass legislation to try to create more protections at the misdemeanor level in that regard, because her father actually was charged with a misdemeanor and was charged with a felony, pled down to misdemeanor and so forth, but didn't have his firearms restricted. So I introduced legislation a couple years ago that was supposed to mirror federal law. And we know in the federal case, if you are convicted for misdemeanor domestic violence, you lose your firearm forever. And so I was proposing actually a conservative bill that said, okay, if you are convicted, you go through all the rights of due process, you are convicted of a misdemeanor domestic violence, you will be denied a firearm for 2 years alone. And just at least a period of time in our state. And I actually did get that out of committee and on the House floor, but it failed by 5 votes. And it was actually a crushing blow. And I got a letter from a man in prison. And I went to visit him, and he said, you know, I've been convicted of felony domestic violence, and had there been a gun there, I would have killed her. So I support your legislation. And I walked away thinking, well, the prisoner gets it.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's where we are with the legislation, but I'd like to reintroduce it, but just can't get it into the legislature.
Rachel,
can I just interrupt? I have to say I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
And you both know, I guess, from reading my book that, you know, there's research done by David Adams in Massachusetts.
Yeah, that's what I wanted you to mention.
Yeah, in which he interviewed 14 men who killed their wives or partners with guns, and 11 of the 14 said that they would not have done it had a gun not been readily available.
And you actually say in your book, one of the more challenging elements of domestic violence is that ideally you want to stop abuse from escalating. But for that to happen, misdemeanors need to be taken more seriously than they generally are in these cases. So I thought that really struck me.
Right. And the other thing about, you know, guns is they're not just used in domestic violence homicides. They're used in intimidation. They're used in all kinds of ways in a domestic violence setting that go beyond just the worst case scenario. And it's demoralizing when I hear, you know, just 2 years, that's nothing. To me, it shows where our value is. You know, we're losing 50 women a month.
Yeah.
We lose more than that every month when you include all the ways in which they're killed, but you know, 50 alone for guns. And yet these bills, and you're not alone. I've heard of other states where just, you know, in fact, that federal law about gun ownership, banning guns from convicted abusers, is just so rarely enforced anywhere in this country.
Rachel, you mentioned in your book the case of Patrick O'Hanlon, who killed his wife and 2 kids. And then you went off to the Family Violence Institute to seek out reasons for why do such heinous crimes happen against families. And you also talked and interviewed a woman at the D.C. Safe House, the headquarters there, where she takes calls about domestic violence. Could you sum up from those 2 experiences and more, for that matter, what's going on here? I mean, in fact, I thought one of those was very interesting, where she talked about disrupting the misdemeanor stage. Could you help us with that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, what we know about domestic violence now is that it is rarely ever static. It almost always escalates. And there are risk indicators that anyone can look at. There are 20, we call them high risk indicators for potential domestic violence homicide. And the website is dangerassessment.org. You can go and look at them. And access to a firearm or gun ownership is one of the top 3. Now, in the cases that you happen to be talking about, Patrick O'Hanlon, he did not use a firearm to kill his family. In fact, he used weights. But what you're trying to do is look at the research that we have of these high-risk indicators, and then you compare that to the timeline of dangerousness. And if you can disrupt, you know, for example, the time between arrest and arraignment, or if you can disrupt those really high levels of dangerous moments, which are when a victim attempts to leave or leaves an abuser, those are often really high risk moments. If you can disrupt those moments, you have a better chance of saving victims. And so that's why, in a way, why your bill makes so much sense. The 2 years is a period of time in which that scale of dangerousness and that escalation can be disrupted.
Right. And, you know, here in Idaho, we actually use a risk of dangerousness assessment, and it was constructed a few years back by a group called the Idaho Coordinated Response Team. That group was put together through the Idaho Coalition Against Sexual and Domestic Violence. They got a grant, and they brought legal professionals to the table to look at some things, and that was one of the things they created. And so we are using that, but the unfortunate part is I don't think we're using it consistently. I had a woman from a rural community last week come into my office and slap it on the desk and say, we need to mandate this right at the scene of the crime. And I think some of our jurisdictions are using it because we know in Idaho there's so many guns, we discover that the greatest risk is when we see the gun moving. So the gun gets moved out of the glove box and onto the seat of the car. So like you're saying, this intimidation, this bigger picture, I may or may not use it, but I'm going to hold you. So that's something I think we need to look at as a state is how do we use that assessment tool and those risk teams more consistently.
Rachel, could you help us understand how we become successful in treating the abusers and how successful we are in turning them around so it doesn't happen again?
Well, that is the $20 million question, or whatever I can't remember the name of that game show.
But, yeah, right.
You know, the research on batterers intervention, there's a wide range of efficacy with batterers intervention programming across the country. It's relatively new, right? You think about the women's movement and building shelters really began in the, you know, late 60s, early 70s. There was no federal law against spousal abuse in this country until 1984. And batterers intervention groups really started proliferating 10 years after that, around the mid-90s. There were a few, mostly in the coastal areas, that had them before that. But it was really only in the wake of the Violence Against Women Act that batterers intervention groups proliferated. And so in that view, they're brand new, right? Like social science and social movements take a long time. What we know is that those who stay in and graduate from batterers groups have a better chance of success than those who leave halfway through their group. It seems like a no-brainer, but this is what the research tells us. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot more that we could be doing. I think that what happens right now is that someone goes through a batterers intervention group, and I cover this a lot in my book because I feel like we don't really listen to the stories of where the violence originates, and I think we need to listen to all the voices that are involved in this. And so what you have right now is you might have a guy or a woman, but most often a guy, go through an entire batterers intervention program, really want to become nonviolent, and then they go right back out into their community with no support. Mm-hmm. You know, even in AA, you have sponsors. So when you want to take a drink, you have someone that you can call in that moment. I think we need to see more of that, frankly. We need to have some sort of transition period for batterers. And I think we need to put a lot more funding toward trying to address violence at its core rather than violence in the aftermath.
You're listening to Rachel Louise Snyder. She's the author of No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. And we're joined by State Representative Melissa Wintrow, who has a comment or a question.
Yeah, I wanted to go back to that root cause issue and with the batterers intervention. And I think throughout your book, you really talk about those root causes. Can you share a little bit more in that regard about maybe rigid gender roles and how that contributes and maybe trauma in certain men's lives?
Sure. I mean, it will be surprising to nobody that about 80% of incarcerated men today have some sort of violence in their backgrounds, either as, you know, child witnesses or child victims. And actually, for women, incarcerated women, that stat, I've seen stats anywhere from 70 to 95% have domestic violence in their backgrounds. So if we don't interrupt this in the origins, if we don't address it, for example, in childhood, we see this cycle repeat generation after generation. So this is another area that I think we need to put more focus. And what ends up happening is that if you are a victim or you witness this kind of trauma in childhood, you very often grow up and become either a perpetrator or a victim yourself. And to me, it's why don't we have more education in schools around this. We've done such good work around, for example, getting people to wear seat belts or, you know, all these social marketing campaigns. And it seems to me that domestic violence is really ripe as a cause for social marketing.
And I think that's a really great point. In fact, I've been talking to some high school students who are just really struggling with, you know, really wanting to have some more education in their school that's realistic and really focuses on healthy relationships. But some of that probably is stymied by some of the political philosophies in our state being quite conservative and reluctant to talk about these kinds of things in school.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. And research is actually telling us that we need to start in middle school now. And it's not just, I mean, I do think that we're getting patriarchal messages, we're getting misogynistic messages from our political leaders, also our mass media. Think about a movie like Twilight, for example, right, where the protagonist of that movie, the main character, sits and watches this woman, you know, his love interest, sleep, sneaks into her room and watches her sleep. And that is sold to young people as romantic. Instead of what it actually is, which is stalking, mm-hmm. breaking and entering and stalking, right? So part of it is the political message. Part of it is the cultural message. You brought up this sort of gendered education that we give to people. You know, I live in Washington, D.C., which is those of us who are residents, you know, it's an incredibly politically progressive and liberal area. I think, you know, Hillary Clinton got 97% of the vote or something like that, like crazy high. And yet, even when I see my child go to school, she comes home with gendered messages and expectations about, you know, what girls do and what boys do and what girls wear and what boys wear. You know, and you see it again. And, you know, you brought up Patrick O'Hanlon in my book, who killed his family. What you see a lot of times with what are called familicides, when someone kills their whole family, is that they live in very gendered, traditionally gendered roles, where the man takes care of the house and everything outside the home, and the woman takes care of the children and does all the housekeeping. And so these kind of rigid roles, I think, are adding to an already complicated problem.
So you have addressed this in your book, and I'm betting that there's somebody out there listening to this who by now is asking the question, well, why don't they just leave? And I want you to answer that for us.
Oh, yeah. I think I spend 95 pages answering that in my book. That question, you know, if I can do one thing with my book, it will be to get us to stop asking that and to start asking the question, why are they violent?
Yeah, right.
You know, the fact is they do leave, but leaving is a process, not an event. Leaving does not look like a suitcase packed at the door going to Vegas, right? It's much messier than that. And it's really the only crime I can think of where the impetus to change or for change is on the victim. You know, I was on The Daily Show a couple of months ago, and I was asked this question, and I said to Trevor Noah, it's sort of like if your house is burgled and you call the police, and the police show up and they say, my God, this is terrible. You've been the victim of a home invasion. Well, you're going to have to come with us now and move out of your house, and the burglar is going to take up residence. You know, it's just like, it's crazy. But, you know, in my book, I talk about a woman named Michelle who knew she couldn't just pack up the kids and move across the street, right? You cannot do that in a dangerous situation because your abuser just simply has control over your life. So she was doing all kinds of things. She had secretly put their rental house, which was owned by her father, in her name. She was taking classes, nursing classes at school, so that she could get a job and someday support her children, right? So leaving is a very, very long-term view. They leave all the time. It just takes years to leave. And they also know that leaving is the most dangerous time. So it's a complicated question, but I think the point for me is to take the responsibility off of the victim and put it on the one who is perpetrating the crime.
You know, I really appreciated that story and the one toward the end where the, I don't know if it was Grace who finally said, look, why should I leave? We'll do the protection order. I'm going to stay in my home. My kid goes to school. It can't be disruptive, all those things. And that really made me, I think you were really talking about the shelter movement in that case, where sometimes certainly we need a place to run and escape and get away. But like you said, it's a process. It's long term. We can't just uproot folks. And so I was talking actually to a shelter director yesterday about their system and trying to create a continuum of transitional housing to permanent supportive housing to all kinds of things. But in the housing crisis we're having here in the United States, in particular in Idaho, it is really a struggle for that 50% who are homeless because of this crime to find a place to live that's affordable.
Yeah, we have that certainly in D.C. And, you know, shelters are temporary and they are, you know, you're housing traumatized people with other traumatized people. You know, if you are caring for an elderly parent, you won't be able to do that. If your kids are on a sports team, they'll have to quit, right, because you're essentially living in seclusion. So shelters are problematic in all sorts of ways. And, you know, unfortunately, the HUD, Housing and Urban Development, is wanting to scale back their funding for transitional housing, which has been longer term, you know, usually around 2 years. And they want that now to be more like 6 months, which is just not a realistic amount of time for a victim or a family who have been victimized of abuse to get up and running, to get, you know, a job, to save enough for first month's rent and security deposit and all that kind of stuff. So it is really a crisis, and it's one of the ways in which domestic violence does intersect all these other social issues that we're facing.
You're listening to Rachel Louise Snyder. She's the author of No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. So when we get really frustrated, Rachel, over the resistance, the inability of the legislature, for example, to move on a piece of legislation, oftentimes where we start is our border states. And we say, well, look what they're doing in Utah. And Utah, by the way, happens to be way more progressive than Idaho. And the thing I learned in your book is that maybe I just shouldn't look at Utah, but I ought to look at Montana when it comes to this issue. I think you cover the fact that they are trying to deal with successful interventions in a way that maybe we could learn something over here in Idaho. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, Montana has done some pretty progressive things when it comes to domestic violence, domestic violence homicide. I do want to preface it by saying that we have new stats about per capita the worst states for domestic violence homicide, and unfortunately Montana just made the top 10 in the most recent stats. I think they're number 10 for per capita domestic violence homicides, but they've done some really small things that have had significant changes. For example, if someone is arrested for domestic violence in the state of Montana, they cannot bail out until they see a judge, and they will not be able to see a judge until the afternoon. And that tiny small change gives advocates or domestic violence police officers enough time to get to a victim to do a danger assessment, much like you have in the state of Idaho, and to come up with a safety plan. And that safety plan might be things like putting an offender on GPS until his court date, or changing the locks in the house, or getting a security system set up in the house. There's all kinds of different things that can be done. So that's one really tiny change. Another thing that they've done is they've taken their restraining orders from paper to a credit card size laminated card that they can carry around with them in their wallet, and they can get multiple copies. And on that, it's called the Hope Card. On that restraining order Hope Card is a picture of the offender, the exclusion zones, the active dates of the restraining order, and victims can get copies to pass around, for example, to their kids' school, to teachers and administrators, to neighbors, to coworkers. And so what that does is signal the community, look, this person is not supposed to be in this area. You should call the police immediately if you see him or her. And these are not expensive changes. They're small things that have been done in Montana. Utah, you say, is more progressive. Utah just built a fabulous state-of-the-art transitional housing building with security, and it's not in a secret location. They've decided that there are no secrets in the age of the internet, so there's no point. So they built it with much higher levels of security in mind.
Melissa.
Yeah. For everybody who is listening out there, you mentioned the Hope Card. And so we actually do have that in Idaho. So if you need that, go to your local shelter. Hopefully the police would also know about that, but you can get that card. And that leads me to really one of the things you said in your book that really struck me. At the very end, you said, if I had to whittle down the changing world of domestic violence to one idea that made all the difference, it would be communication. And that this is a free resource and that it's important that people talk to one another. So I'm really interested in that comment, as well as how do we continue to bring law enforcement and community advocates together to see their unique but complementary roles.
I think that's so true, that it's about communication. And when I say communication, I don't just mean systems, right? I don't just mean that healthcare needs to communicate more with advocates, who need to communicate with law enforcement. That certainly needs to happen. And I think I talk about in my book, I talk about high risk teams and how effective they have been. It sounds like maybe you have one there in Idaho. I'm not sure. But I also think one of the things that we can learn from the Me Too movement, and I see this as a sort of corollary to the Me Too movement, is that we need to dispel the shame around talking about domestic violence. And so we as community members need to be able to have those conversations with our friends and with our coworkers. You know, domestic violence victims go to clergy far more often than they go to domestic violence advocates. So I think we need to think beyond just the systems that are directly involved, right? I was at a conference last week at a family justice center, and they had representatives from Motel 6 there who were trying to find out how they could be involved, which made total sense when you think about victims running will often go, like, Motel, isn't that where Tina Turner went, actually? I think she went to a Motel 6. So that felt to me so creative and innovative, and I think you're absolutely right when you talk about, you know, high school students wanting more education and what does a healthy relationship look like. And so, you know, and I'm in the media. I think we are involved in that as well. You know, one of the more shocking things for me, I know that you've read a lot of shocking things in my book, but one of the shocking things for me was to stand on my friend's driveway 10 years ago and to listen to a domestic violence advocate tell me about all these different myths around domestic violence, that restraining orders work, that shelters are an adequate response to domestic violence, that if things are bad enough, victims just leave, that, you know, people who are violent will never become nonviolent. It was shocking to me, not only because I suddenly learned that I had bought into all these myths, but that I am in a system myself, the media, and we have done a very poor job of communicating to the public as well around this issue. So I guess I see communication as the key from the living room right all the way up to the legislation.
Representative Wintrow.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you a question. A few times in the book, you note that LGBTQ couples fare no better in the system, and transgender folks than heterosexual couples. Here in the state of Idaho, we don't have legal protections for people who are gay, lesbian, and transgender. They can legally be thrown out of their home, their rental. They can lose a job, be denied services. So can you talk about some of the gaps you saw that exist for LGBT couples and other historically marginalized communities?
Yeah, it's funny. I just want to mention that my research assistant, who's fabulous, is from Idaho. She's always talking to me about Idaho.
All right.
And I didn't know that specifically about LGBTQ, but I know that the research shows that, you know, the rates of violence in LGBTQ relationships are often higher than in heterosexual couples, I think because of these vulnerabilities, right, like social vulnerabilities that people in these marginalized groups have. And you're right, there are shelters that still today can refuse housing to LGBTQ victims. I was just reading last night on the website Survived and Punished, which is a movement to get predominantly women, although others too, who have killed their abusers in self-defense and been sent to prison to get them out of prison. And I was just reading about a transgender victim who spent 3 years in prison pre-trial. I can't remember what state. that person was in. But, you know, this is an area in which we're not only under-researched, but we're underfunded, we're under-resourced in every way. And the 2013 Violence Against Women Act did try to build in more protections for LGBTQ people. But, of course, 2018 reauthorization of violence against women has not been reauthorized. It's sitting on Mitch McConnell's desk. And so those people are potentially as vulnerable as they were 6 or 7 years ago.
Well, and I think that's one of the major conflicts, right, is that some of the Republican Congress people do not want to provide protections that we've always been providing in that federal funding for LGBTQ folks.
Well, the big holdup this time, so 2013, that was really when the bill began to be partisan, when you really saw the bipartisan efforts that had always been with VAWA breakdown was in 2013, and it was around LGBTQ and Native and immigrant protections. This time in 2018, it's breaking down, ironically for you, around guns. And for the first time ever, the NRA came out and opposed the Violence Against Women Act because they wanted more federal protection for victims and they wanted stricter gun rules for convicted felons around domestic violence. So that's been the holdup publicly. Of course, nothing seems to be getting passed, so it's just one of many. But, you know, the Trump administration, 3 years in, still has not even, there's no one, he hasn't even put anyone into the Office of Violence Against Women. It's still an acting head. So it shows you where their priorities are.
Well, and I went to the website to look for the Council on Women and Girls that was created many years ago, and it's just gone. And the statement there is because of redundancy and not use, it's gone.
Rachel, we can't thank you enough for taking time to talk with us about this most important issue all the way here from Idaho. Again, the name of the book is No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us, by Rachel Louise Snyder. And my guest today in the studio has been State Representative Melissa Wintrow, who in her own right has introduced a bill that here in Idaho would ban gun ownership for 2 years for those convicted of any type of domestic violence. Thanks again, Rachel. Enjoyed having you at Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much.
Rachel Louise Snyder and Melissa Wintrow, thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner. Next week, tune in to hear our talk with Robert Kanacki about the important book he co-authored with Richard Clark, The Fifth Domain, Defending Our Country, Our Companies, and Ourselves in the Age of Cyber Threats. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.